welcome to this panel on securing the code, building resilience, security and agile into coding design and development. And I'll hand straight over to Andrew, our moderator.
Thank you, Victoria. And wow, end of the first day, and thank you for all coming along to our session. It looks like a very good turnout. So, securing code, building in resilience, dealing with the potential conflict in interests of security and agile development, and considering the design and development issues that are relevant to today's business operations. That's what we want to cover this afternoon. And hopefully we'll make this a good interactive session, because we do realise that we're the only thing that's keeping you from beer, wine, or the beverages of your choice at the end of the day. I'm Andrew Kellett, security analyst at Ovum. For those of you who've not come across us before, think of us as a cuddly and more friendly version of Gartner. So I'm the outsider looking in, because I've got an expert panel who are more capable of discussing the key issues here than I am. Now, at this stage, I usually forget who my panel is and make a complete idiot of myself. But as you saw, the guy on the mics has put everybody in the right order. So from the far end, we've got Adrian Asher, Chief Information Security Officer, London Stock Exchange Group. Lee Barney, Head of Information Security at Marks & Spencer. Mieke Coy, Security Director at Trainline. And John Townend, Technology and Information Security Director at National Trust. Four important, but on the face of it, very different business organisations. So what I'm looking for is the opinions of the panel, the opportunity for you, the audience, to ask questions, and a good all-round session. So before I open up with some wider questions, I'd like to hear from the panel their view on the subjects, what the issues are as far as their organisations are concerned, and we'll take things from there. So using the creeping death approach, Adrian, over to you.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for all being here. So for me, this always starts with the idea of what is it you're trying to protect? You're trying to protect some data. You're trying to allow a certain user or an identity to be able to connect to it. And obviously, that happens through an application. So for me, all of this topic is really about how do you actually do those three things? Would you use cloud? Do you use micro-segmentation? Have you got legacy issues to take care of? And of course, no panel will be complete without mentioning GDPR. So some of the stuff we're going to talk about during this panel for me is about how can you get developers doing more, but doing it securely, not with no governance, but with different governance. And those are some of the challenges that we face as we try to deploy products to the cloud, to legacy environments, to data centers, and so on, every day, 24/7 if we can. And that's the challenge that we're all facing.
Lee.
Thanks. Hello, everyone. Well, the fact that you're sat here tells me one of two things. Either you don't realize that 4:30, the beer is free on the main floor, or that you love security and coding. Well, both of those do tell me is that you're not software engineers, so that's good, because I'm not a software engineer. I am the head of information security for Marks & Spencer. But what I will say is we absolutely have managed to grapple the challenges and opportunities presented by agility. And we have a particular framework that we use, which we call the Agile Security Framework, we're not that inventive, that allows us to release code at speed in a secure manner. And I look forward to talking to you all about that in a minute.
Thank you. Mieke.
Over to me. I'm Mieke Coy from Trainline. Trainline is a little bit of a different organization because it is pretty much all about the digital and the agile. All of our staff are sort of versed in sort of security of applications, and I literally mean all of that. We actually train everyone in this area, and 50% of that actual staff are actually in the tech team and are developers. So we are, besides retailing train tickets online, we are actually kind of a development house. So this is something that is very close to our heart and is very important, given that our applications and our face out to the world is everything to us.
John.
John Townsend. As the Technology and Information Security Director, I get to worry about both sides of this. get to worry about all the bad things that the developers are doing and then all of the things that the security team are or aren't doing in order to stop them doing that. I'm minded of a quote from Gene Kim's book, with the Phoenix Project, if anyone's familiar with that, which talks about the only thing more dangerous than a developer is a developer working in conjunction with an InfoSec guy. And the reason for that is that they have the means, the motive, and the opportunity to do crazy things together. Yeah. And so what we've got to be able to do as a community is actually get those two functions working seamlessly together, and hopefully that's something that we can talk about this afternoon.
So, okay. So John, in the Phoenix project, the InfoSec manager was called John, I believe.
He was.
He shaved his head and had a breakdown and was alcoholic.
Yeah, I moved into technology as well.
Just the name, the similarity?
It is. I think it's a story that reflects many of the truths that we've all lived through our careers. Okay. Not necessarily the head shaving thing.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Agile was mentioned there a couple of times. So what I'd like to do is start with a fairly basic question and then move on to some of the Agile stuff and get views on the impact of that. So exploring the vulnerability position further. The intro to this talked about the amount of code that gets generated, and it's an ongoing thing. The thing that occurs to me as an outsider looking in is that a lot of the vulnerabilities that we find are the same vulnerabilities we were finding 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago. Yeah, what's in the National Institute of Standards and Technologies, NIST top list, to me, a lot of stuff seems to stay there, and we seem to struggle to fix it. So how do we solve the problems that we know about? Indeed, is it practical to believe that we can deal with some of these common problems? John, perhaps?
It is, but not in the old-fashioned ways. Mm-hmm. So we've got mm-hmm. old-fashioned problems to deal with still, but we have to do it in new and innovative ways. You're right, you know, the volume of sheer volume of code, and it's not just code that our developers are developing themselves, it's open source libraries that they're using, it's other people's products, it's integration with APIs and all of those things. For me, early testing of automation or automation testing techniques looking for those security vulnerabilities at the get-go, when the developer is actually busy hacking the code, can save you an awful lot of pain and misery further down the line, where traditionally that's where the InfoSec team would have come along with a pen test and said to the developer, your code's rubbish. You know, we've got SQL injection vulnerabilities here and, you know, all this and the other. Why aren't the developers front-loading that? Yeah? So that it's a much cheaper and cost-effective way for organizations to deal with vulnerabilities, but you do it at source. You don't wait for that to be just ready to go into production.
I think that's a very interesting point, because one of the other things that I picked up from NIST is that after the initial design phase, it's six and a half times more expensive to find and fix development flaws, 15 times more expensive in testing, 100 times more expensive in production. And what they say is, and let's see if I can get this right, the cost of retrospective remediation and testing is so much higher because you aren't dealing with what the application does, but what it unintentionally allows. Interesting. Can I move on to you, Mika?
Move on to me. Is it sort of a question on that, or is that just a...
I think that the same sort of question about the core vulnerabilities mm-hmm. and how we should be dealing
how
with them as opposed to how we are at the moment dealing with them.
No, that's quite true, because as you know, sort of, we all know that a lot of the things that we're seeing that we're trying to stop are things that we have known about that have been in the, you know, sort of OAuth top 10 for many, many years. These are things that developers should know. They've been trained again and again and again, obviously not to the quality that we would like. So the sort of old style approach of throw some training in, throw some requirements in, and hope the right thing comes out at the other end just doesn't work. For us, it was sort of moving away from that cycle of testing and fixing and finding things that really does slow you down, and becoming more agile along with our developer community, but also our product owner community that sort of influenced the developers. So having the sort of product owners alongside us saying to those developers that were building things for them that this stuff actually mattered went a long way. We also reached into those developer communities and sort of got champions, people that actually wanted to be doing security. Because let's face it, a lot of developers and software engineers are in this for something other than security. They're having fun with the functionality that they're putting out. And you know what? I don't necessarily want to get in the way of that. I just want to put things alongside what they're doing that mean that they can deliver quality and security at the same time.
Okay. Lee, how do we get to that position with the developers? Push them towards the security side of things?
Andrew, we've got to wake up as an industry. And Mika makes a really good point about making sure that you're closer to the software engineers and closer to the product owners. If you consider, there is a growing dichotomy in business at the moment. On one hand, we've got increasing regulations, we've got increasing legislation, we've got NIST standards that are becoming more and more prevalent in terms of our expectations that developers should be following. We've probably all got secure coding guidelines, and we've probably all got governance in the terms of policy, patterns and standards. But then, on the other hand, you've got software engineers who don't give a crap about any of that, and their mantra in the agile world is working code over documentation. Well, clearly, if their mantra is working code over documentation, they're really not going to care if you come to them with NIST SP 800XXX and that many pages and say, make sure you follow that. Even going to them and saying, follow the OWASP top 10 is too much of a challenge. Mika's approach is the right approach, and that is make sure you get to your developers at the point they arrive in your organization and then continuously train them in things that you expect. Now, that's not train them in your acceptable use policy. That's train them how to code securely so that if you've got a red team, which I'm very fortunate to have, or if you've got penetration testers that work with you, they can code to the same level of security that they can. Because in theory, if you train the software engineers to actually code properly in the first place and code securely, then the amount of effort you need to expend in terms of penetration testing or red teaming to find the issues will just dissipate. And what you will be finding is very small things are relatively easy to fix. And not only will they be easy to fix, they'll be really easy to fix because the engineers will know how to fix them. Because it'll just be a case of, oh, I didn't realize that was there. So, a bit like John said, we need to kind of throw away the concept that we have in the past of how to do security and reinvent security for the new way of working in an agile manner. And let's be honest, agile isn't really that new. But certainly the way that software engineers use it against us is absolutely new. And they basically want to race ahead and develop at pace and deliver what the business is asking them for, and that is making money. But we need to work at pace alongside them and not become a barrier.
Okay, thanks. Adrian, are you comfortable talking about the agile side of things? So we've got a question here that's come in from the audience. What are some of the practical ways to introduce automated testing into code development? I think that fits in with the agile approach.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting because to me, it's never been easier to write secure code. We have application static code analysis. We have application development training that Lee was sort of just mentioning. We have general awareness training, phishing training. We've got all these tools. We also have the advent of moving away from trying to traditional monolithic applications into microservice architecture, whether you want to put that in a platform as a service, container or something. I actually really like event-driven, so some people call it serverless. It's never been easier to write that code securely. So we've got all these tools, we've got all of this training available. We just need to couple that with the developers. I always say, and everybody else does, you know, security is there to enable. I think we're not doing a good enough job at enabling developers. Developers don't want to write insecure code. They want to write secure code because they know that the business needs them to write secure code, otherwise it doesn't get to production, or indeed if it gets to production and has a data breach, you know, they're going to be asked, why did you write that sort of insecure code? As we shift the accountability from security securing something to the developers writing secure code and information security assuring that they have done that correctly, it changes the way we do it. Specifically, how do we introduce automated testing into that? I've got a philosophy about how to do sort of testing, certainly on like APIs. There's tons of static code analysis tools you can go and buy and you can implement that. I'd always say make sure you run them on the developer's workstations rather than they check in and then overnight they get a report back. That's too late. It needs to be just in time. It needs to be at the point somebody's written, you know, a few modules of code. They need to know specifically any vulnerabilities they've just written or any vulnerabilities that they are in code they are dependent upon. Those are the two things. Most data code analysis engines won't do that for you. So you really need to work with your vendors when you're selecting these tools to make sure they can do those things. Because if you've got an application that's, let's say, millions of lines of code, and a developer's gone in and just written, let's say, 100 lines of code, if you tell them about code that was written 2 years ago by somebody else in a part of the app that was not even used, you know, by you and maybe not even used anymore, that's useless to them. The closer we get to microservices, where the only code they've written is the only thing that exists in that little app, if you will, the better it will be and the easier the automated testing can become.
Okay. John, I think you've got something to add to that.
The only thing I'd add to that is that working within a DevOps environment, you've got a team of people around the developers who are more used to this whole automation process. So actually, that knowledge you can then, you know, pull into how you do automation testing and have that code package that pushed out. You don't even have to have it necessarily on on the developer's machine themselves. You can just use it as a service. It's all available out there. There's plenty of tools that can do it.
Okay. Mika, there was a question there about, going back to what you were saying about training, and I wondered if you could go into that.
Yeah, I did see that pop up, and I thought, wow, they actually spelled my name right. Whoever that was, much appreciated. It never happens. Training comes in all sorts of different shapes and sizes, and we've tried a few before we hit what we think is the right combination at Trainline. So some of that is computer-based, sort of good old-fashioned computer-based training where people can dive in and out. But with, I'm not going to name names of companies or suppliers. People are welcome to talk to me offline. But we did, sort of run through a couple of suppliers before we landed with the one we've got that keep things up to date, that keeps things fun, and covers a breadth of topics. So that was important, having that knowledge base there for them to go back to. We also bring in external trainers to do specialist training relevant to the different development clusters or product teams or areas that we have and the business. And then my team also runs ongoing sessions. We have a champion community called the MacGyvers. Every team has a fun name, but mine are the MacGyvers. They do monthly sessions with them. And those can, some of it's, sort of learning security, but we also teach them things like lock picking. Not for to do any bad, but because, sometimes the easiest way in is just through the data center door, and it makes people stop and think. So that combination of different things, getting the in-person, the grab it when you want to, the computer-based, and then sort of more ad hoc things, that works really well for us. You've always got to be there. It's you can't ever be out of mind.
Thank you. I'm used to sort of the heckling from the audience by this stage, but I do want to say this is now an interactive session, and we're picking up the questions from the screen in front of us, and the last two or three have been from the audience. And the next one that I've got actually ties up with the second question I had on my list to ask to the panel, and it's about how do you sell security to engineering teams that are under pressure? My take on this was how do you do this for hard-pressed, under-pressure development folks, and how do you emphasize the benefits of getting it right the first time and including the security environment in what you're doing? I wonder if you could pick that one up, Lee, please.
Yeah, I can. And Andrew, I think if we struggle to sell it to this audience, because believe it or not, some of you have actually fallen asleep already, and yes, we can see that.
That's only me.
I know. I blame you completely. I'm clearly more energetic. But as we look to software engineers or developers, you've really got to understand exactly what it is that motivates them. And that's why I started with that kind of flippant remark earlier on about, well, you clearly can't be software engineers because the bar's down there and it's free. You have to understand what motivates them before you can understand how best to jangle their bells so you can actually sell it to them. In terms of what we did at M&S, we have, like Mika has, regular training sessions with our software engineers. We sit them all down, we take them away, we take them off-site, so we find a window of opportunity where they're not coding something, they're not coding a major release that's about to go in. We take them away, take them for 2 days, and we train them in secure coding. And then on the last day, we turn them on a pre-production instance of the website, and we say, right, now go and hack that. And what we'll do is we'll give you a prize if you find some vulnerabilities in there. And it's their site that they have coded, that they have helped to make stable and secure, to quote Theresa May. That shouldn't do that, right? That is the quickest way to motivate them. And it absolutely worked. We gave them a quadcopter for somebody who, I can't remember what they found. I think they found a simple cross-site scripting attack that was then fixed by that same person, which makes me think they probably knew about it as they went in just to get the quadcopter. But nevertheless, understand what motivates them, then use that motivation against them and get them to go and look at their own site. And that seems to work.
Okay, great, thanks.
Yes. Sorry, can I just add something that as Lee was speaking, I thought, you know, what we haven't mentioned is the top and how important it is that the sort of, you know, the top and the leadership live and breathe this stuff as well. I'm very fortunate that our CTO, when he's talking, he says security, reliability, functionality in that order. And he also has given me 25% of the MacGyver community's time, so it's officially in their objectives. And we had a lot of trouble before that happened. You know, sort of keeping their attention, because let's face it, they're busy. They're busy doing other things. They've got lots of pressures. We're agile. We're delivering. But by actually putting it in there, it's official. We can, you know, sort of deal with their dev managers and make sure that the security gets prioritized with their time.
Okay. Just before we move on, John or Adrian, anything?
Yeah, and for me, I'd like, you know, to have this just part of the DNA of the organization. So there isn't this, you know, the security team says this, the engineering team says this, you know, the web ops team says this, the developers saying this. Actually, it's just one team. I'd almost like to get rid of the security team. I hope there's none of them in here. But yeah, I mean that in a way that it just becomes part of the culture of the organization. I don't think any presentation in this you know, year is going to be quite complete without mentioning GDPR. Gives every organization a real powerful lever to focus everyone's attention. You know, in how you deliver security by design into everything that you do. Mm-hmm. And developers have got, you know, as much a part to play in that. But changing the DNA of the organization so that everybody thinks about privacy and security, so that the people who are putting those engineering teams under pressure actually understand what the implications are to them, because it's ultimately their neck on the line anyway.
And I think the natural follow-on from that is a question that we've got on the top of the board at the moment. What challenges did each of your organizations face embedding a security culture within your technical teams, and what advice would you give? I think John started to answer that, but perhaps we could go along from the far end and get some thoughts.
Sure, I mean, I guess I echo what John was saying. You know, getting that buy-in, and Mika as well, from the top is really critical. Giving them the tools to do their jobs, you know, getting out of the way of them producing code. You know, you don't want to have your humans in your teams being in there. When you can automate that, you can make them self-sufficient, they can do self-assert, and they have to want to do it, and selling them on, I don't like using regulation as an excuse, so I don't like, because of GDPR we have to do this, because of audit we have to do this, it's because it's the right thing to do. Yep. I mean, to Mika's priority order, I completely agree with it, security, reliability, features, you know, that has to be the way to go. Developers want to write code and they want to get it out there. If you give them tools to do that in a secure fashion, they'll use them. If you make it easier to do the right thing and punish extremely doing the wrong thing, then you'll naturally just move people over to doing the right thing. I think the big shift is when you make the developers accountable for writing secure code and information security accountable for assuring that that's happened. That's a big change. People still think about information security securing the systems. We're not there to do that. We can't scale. It means I'd have to have one application security for every 10 or 20, you know, developers. We're not going to do that. We can use tools, we can use technology, and, you know, a little bit of governance.
Thanks. I think the interesting thing from my perspective is, back in the days when I was working on the development side of things, back in the days when I was doing the engineering, the systems testing side, security actually wasn't one of those things that came up. All I had to do was to make sure that the thing worked as it said on the sheet of paper that I had in front of me, test it, deliver it, and try and make sure that the window of opportunity that the developers left us was enough to get it out there and live. But what that then takes us to is the environments that we're working in at the moment. And so coming back to the DevOps and Agile approach, and I was wondering if I could get some comments on how that has changed the way that we look at security and the way we address vulnerabilities that are found as we're going along. Would anyone like to take that one?
Happy to start.
John.
Yeah, I mean, you know, with DevOps, if you're doing it properly, if you're moving to a continuous delivery model, you can't afford not to do this properly because you just don't have the time. Yeah. So if you know, we talked about delivering, Lee talks about delivering business value consistently and constantly. If you're going to go to that type of model, you cannot wait until after you have finished implementing code and getting it ready for release to start your security testing. You've got to do it up front. It's as simple as that. So that whole moving to an automated continuous delivery DevOps model actually means that everybody has got to adopt a security posture in whatever they do.
And is that something that you've experienced in your own environment?
Yeah, to our detriment when we started trying to implement Agile and digital delivery in the whole, because we were, you know, effectively calling something Agile but doing a waterfall delivery model. And that's been in a number of places that I've worked for people to truly move to a DevOps function where it is, you know, constant continuous delivery. You've got to change the whole mindset. You have to adopt that culture of everybody owns security, not the security team.
And that also applies to the information security team. So if you change the development team towards Agile, you know, DevOps and so on, you must make sure in your information security team that you have people that can code. You need people that can talk to the developers on a peer basis, yep. You know, one-to-one, and be able to explain things. You need security architects. And I don't mean enterprise architects. When I've been recruiting recently for a chief security architect, I really struggled to find people that actually understood applications, how to build and design and operate in the cloud securely, because all they've done before is put a Windows server here or a Linux server here and a database here. That's not information security today. It's at the application level, it's at the identity level, and it's at the data level. So I've got to take my team through that transition as well as obviously the development teams.
Yeah, I mean, that's completing it. Completes the picture. That idea that your team has to be comprised of people that actually can break what these guys are building. And to sort of understand the code enough, understand the security loopholes, and to sort of wow those developers to wake them up. And that, for us, that was something we really focused on, was getting the right people into the security team. And I'm thrilled with the team that I do have, because they all have such gravitas when they're talking about these things. It's clearly something they love to do, you know, sort of break things, make things better, work with the teams, and to get those aha moments among the development community and the product community when they realize just what could go wrong if they don't build things right. So that's critical.
So building out from that is that a success criteria, something that you've achieved?
It is. Security in terms of that, I mean, it's just like everyone else here, we've got it in our pipeline. So as we're in the cloud, we're definitely in continuous delivery, hundreds of releases a week. Everything goes through a pipeline that takes it through the static code scanning and the app testing. And they have, you know, within the definition of quality, we have security, and they have, you know, sort of based on the different risks of the things that are going in, they've got to fix things. So it's, if you're working on a payments application or one that processes personal data, it's not going in with a bunch of criticals and reds flagged in the different security tests. And we don't need to touch anything for that to happen. That gets flagged up to the teams. We can go in to help if they need it. So it becomes a lot easier as you move to that DevOps and automation.
Lee, would you like final word on this one?
Yeah, and I'm actually going to reflect on something that Adrian mentioned earlier on, because I think it's a really important point, and that is about putting the responsibility for security at the point of the person's actually doing the change. Now, for the CISOs in the room, and for the head ofs, and for everybody else who's responsible or even accountable for security in your organization, you're probably familiar with the three lines of governance. Right? It's not necessarily a security thing, but it's certainly language that the board speaks. Three lines of governance quite simply says, whoever is doing the do, they're the first line, then you've got the checkers, and you've got the checkers of the checkers. Right? It's not rocket science. But just surprisingly, so many organizations don't do that. And surprisingly, so many organizations don't translate that into a security objective. Well, from my perspective, I think that's actually what Adrian was saying. And that is, put the responsibility for doing the secure code onto the responsibility of the developers, of the software engineers. And that's what we're all saying. So the biggest takeaway you should take away from this is, if you're doing one thing right, it is because you have trained and enabled your software engineers to do secure coding themselves. And then everything else is about checking to make sure they do that. And then how you go about doing that is entirely up to you. One of the questions that I see down there that I'm hoping we're going to get to is about DevSecOps and DevOps. And actually, you know, is any of those realistically relevant to how a good security department or security team should function? In my opinion, not really. But that's because we use the three lines of governance. And we are a check-in function or a second line assurance function of the software engineers.
See, I hate the term DevSecOps. If I can just
so
talk
about,
I think development and operations include security. You develop secure code, you operate securely. Why do you need to have another word in there?
Yeah.
The bottom question, can I just answer that? Because I love that question.
Absolutely.
So software engineer, how do you keep devs engaged in a small company when there's no InfoSec team? Any developer that writes secure code is more marketable. Get those skills, learn how to write secure code, learn how to be a security champion, and then either get more money where you are or move somewhere else and get more money there. Because the market needs more information security personnel, needs more developers that write secure code. So self-learn, you know, there's tons of resources. OWASP has been mentioned, NIST has been mentioned. Tons of these free resources online. You can do various university courses now for free. There's tons of material out there. Just self-learn, show that you're an expert, a master of it, become the CISO in that company, or indeed move elsewhere and double your salary-ish.
So that question was software engineer here. How do you keep devs engaged with security when there is no InfoSec team or champion? And it says small company environment. Typically, I think that's more of a common problem than just the small end of the environment. It's difficult to recruit security expertise these days. So there must be a lot of development environments, IT teams that have to cover the security side of things but don't have the specialists. John, would you like to pick up on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, I mean, we talked a little bit about OWASP here. Quick show of hands in the audience. I mean, you're all security professionals, IT technology leaders. Who has everyone heard of OWASP? Everyone hands up, yeah? So how many people are aware of the latest version of it, the April 2017 version? Okay, how many people can tell me the two OWASP top 10 controls that changed in that 2017 version? And you guys are the security guys. Yeah, that terrifies the bejesus out of me because those two new controls that were implemented have real implications on our development teams, real implications. They tell them about securing APIs, and they tell them about defending against attacks. Detecting and defending against attacks. Yeah? Pretty critical things, you're a developer, to know about that. So if we as a community don't know about that, how on earth have those two guys in that small organization got a chance of knowing anything about it?
Interesting.
Can I add to that?
Of course.
But before I do, can I just say, does anybody else panic when they see Anonymous coming up on the screen up there? Or is it just me? If you could put your names down, that would be great. So to the software engineer in the room, I can't believe there's one of you. There is free beer down there. In fact, to all of you, you have to realise you are not responsible for, in fact, sorry, you're responsible for security, but you're not accountable for security. That is actually sits with the CEO or the MD in a small organisation. What I'm trying to say is you can spend ages on a spinning bike spinning, but you're not going to go anywhere. You might get really fit, but you're not going to go anywhere. You need to get on your mountain bike, and that's exactly what you need to do with this. You need to go to the people in the organization who are responsible, who are accountable for it, and change their opinion. Because there's no point trying to influence the people to the left and to the right of you. It's the people at the top of the organization. They're the ones that make the decisions, and they're the ones who ultimately own the company, with the exception of a PLC company. So they're the people that you need to go and talk to or try and get time with. And if you can't get time with those people because they're not interested in security, that's either because you're really bad at selling, in which case get somebody else to do it, or because they really don't care, in which case go somewhere else. Because ultimately, if you show an interest in security, let's just be clear here, right, and you start becoming known as a security champion, yet you don't have accountability for it, when it goes wrong, they're going to point to you. So don't enable them to create that environment within which security can just be completely ignored, because that's not fair on you, and it's not realistic, it's not fair on the organization. They need to buy on it.
Okay, thanks. Mika, anything to add to that?
I mean, absolutely. leading from the top is everything, and I think that goes no matter what size company you have. If you've got a small, even a handful of developers or people working together to build something, it's make sure that the people that really are sort of the top of whatever org you're in understand that it's like they've got to accept that if they're pushing back on security or not wanting it, that there is a cost to that, and the cost sits with them.
So I suppose moving on from that, the next question we have is, do you implement DevOps? Has it helped to making code more secure in your organizations? And alongside that, like to think about the speed of throughput in the agile environment and the impact that that has as well. Adrian, would you like to kick
off? Yeah, I mean, when I joined Skype, we were doing a release probably every quarter. Maybe, you know, we'd miss a quarter and it would become half yearly. We went over to Agile and then ultimately to DevOps. And we were releasing every month with Agile, and then every week, if not every day, and much, you know, many, many more teams. So it helped making the code more secure, because when a vulnerability was found, whether it was pre-live or, you know, in live, we were able to get that fixed in days or weeks rather than a quarter or a half year. So absolutely. Obviously, the more we could, to your point earlier, about the earlier we could find that bug or that vulnerability, you know, the cheaper it was. So we kept trying to move it to the left. So it did make us more secure. It meant we were more secure operating as well. And also when vulnerabilities, or when, let's say, a denial of service attack happened, instead of having to just use an external provider to prevent it, you know, we can do that for all the basic attacks. But when application attacks come in, you need to adapt. You need to be able to change your infrastructure, your application. And, you know, an agile sort of DevOps mode allows you to do that much quicker than any traditional change control based legacy kind of infrastructure ever would. So DevOps is a very big benefit for security.
Okay. Mika, you and I were talking before the meeting about what happens to the vulnerabilities that are found, given the fast-moving nature of things. And I think you talked about the severity of the vulnerabilities.
Yeah, that sort of taking it down to risk and sort of the feedback loop. What DevOps does give you is that very clear pipeline and the feedback loop to know right away at the different points of testing and the different points at which you could possibly either choose to let something through because something is lower risk and say we can fix that later, or say this is a hard stop because you deal with payments. So you sort of have this balance between making sure your highest risk things are going in clean as a whistle and saying, actually, you know, for some of the lower risk things, we're okay if that feedback loop happens slightly after live, to say there's some things where you kind of go, that can happen within, say, you know, a week of something going live because it's not going anywhere near personal data. So it all comes together in that DevOps space.
Okay, thanks. John, there's a question there about what is the equivalent to a sign-off design against the associated risk assessments by stakeholders in the agile world. Is that one you could address?
I think, yeah, I mean, that to me is a sort of classic thing I used to argue with about security teams that would come along at the end of a development cycle with a clipboard and say, right, we're going to check you off against these, you know, 158 non-functional requirements, and then we're going to do a pen test, and then we're going to tell you all the reasons why you can't put this into production. So it's a completely different mindset. So, you know, it's having everybody, yes, there is a pipeline, but it's an automated pipeline that says that all of the checks and balances to have a proper change control for things going into production have been done. Yeah, but it's not a sort of, you know, absolute barrier at every point in the chain. It's understanding what it is you're putting into production and what, you know, if you have to have a rollback option, the ability to do that. I think, you know, the idea of a signed off design within Agile is actually just, you know, that constant, what is your product development strategy and how's that going to evolve over time? Mm-hmm. Agile isn't an excuse for not documenting things properly, though.
Damn, I thought it was. Lee, is that similar in your organization, or do you have a slightly different take?
I think I've already answered this. Software engineers will say, you know, working code over documentation every single time. And that sometimes means that there's no documentation. I mean, on the back of a fag packet or the beer mat, whatever, sometimes it's literally all you'll get, or that the assurance team will get to assure a change. I like I say, I'm fortunate I have a red team, which allows me to take a step back from this. Yeah. And actually, the reason why I've already answered this, because I mentioned the first line of responsibility. We cannot sign something off if we don't own it. We don't sign off code. That's done by the person that's responsible for doing that in the first place, because they've been trained. What we will do is go and check their code occasionally to make sure they're doing it. And the way we get around to checking that code is by checking it based on the level of risk that that change actually has. So if it's a major release, and that major release changes credit card data, or interacts with credit card data, or personally identifiable data, then clearly we're going to be all over that like a rash. And we're going to do that before the thing's released. If, however, it's just changing, I don't know, a store location where you go in, where's the nearest Marks and Spencer? One that's near a Costa coffee shop because I want to go there afterwards. Then in which case, we don't really care about it. Well, we do care about it, but we care about it less because the risk to the business is slightly less. So what we'll do is we'll red team that at a point in the future. The point is, you really have to let this go. You cannot release at speed and do security checkpoints. You cannot become a bottleneck. And that is nothing new now in Agile than it was under Waterfall years ago. And it will be no different now than it will be in 20 years' time. So stick to the three lines of governance, stay in your place, and act as a point of escalation if somebody comes asking for your help or your assistance.
Yeah, I'd add to that and say that I have security design patterns. People can apply like a cloud native design pattern, as long as they're following everything that the pattern specifies. You know, they don't have to engage with my team. We get notified, but we're not a gate. But at the point that they actually want to deviate from what's been agreed in the pattern, then they have to come and have that conversation. It's also based on business imperatives like Lee described.
Can I just add to that as well, to Lee's point on documentation, I actually find in the Agile world, we're getting better information about what's getting built because we can put in checkpoints that capture information right up front as soon as someone says, actually, I've got an idea I want to think about building. We get them to answer questions. We don't have to go around with that checklist anymore to get the information. It's in there or they can't move on. And that automatically gives me, you know, sort of my risk and my follow through. Everything that sits in my cloud space, it's got the right metadata and tagging around it, so I know what it's got, and I can pull out information on my systems. And that is a foundation that a lot of us dreamed about before we landed in the cloud and in the Agile world.
I think that's brilliant because experience tells me that looking back at old legacy systems, one of the biggest problems when organizations come to change the code and deal with the issues is lack of information about who wrote it, what they wrote, and all that good quality documentation that you're now talking about building into the Agile way of working. We're almost running out of time. That hour, that was 50 minutes, wasn't it? It's almost passed. So let's go with a simple question. And along the panel, let's look at favorite code analysis tools. John. Let's start.
With all these security vendors here, there's no way I'm doing product endorsement, so forget that.
Types of tools.
Nice try.
Types of tools, I would say.
Automation. Yeah. Every time. Yeah. Automation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Beacon.
The brain.
Yeah. And you know what? It's irrelevant. It doesn't matter to me because ultimately the developers know exactly what they need to do, so they go and pick the tool that they feel meets their best need. You know, if I was running an electrician company, I wouldn't necessarily go and mandate exactly what kind of screwdriver somebody uses. It's up to them. Providing it doesn't electrocute them when they put it in a plug socket, who cares?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, it doesn't matter what the information security department favorite is, because they're not the ones that are going to be running it every single day. You know, the developer is many, many times a day. So sure, you can vet it to make sure that it's, you know, appropriate in terms of the coverage and false positives and so on, but you have to work with your developer teams rather than forcing things onto them and saying, this is the tool, go use it. If that tool sucks, they're going to circumvent it. So it doesn't matter at all. It really is up to the developers and, you know, just work with them.
That's great. I didn't expect any actual tool names there. I mean, from an analyst's perspective, I guess we try not to endorse anything apart from when we get to the stage where we try and compare the features and benefits of these types of tools. So we've just about run out of time. So
thank you for the not anonymous one at the bottom.
Yeah, that's awesome. Whoever that is, you're epic.
Yes, good person at the bottom there. So could I ask you to put your hands together and give a round of applause to a very good and very articulate panel. And finally, just thank you for staying with us, and I hope you enjoyed the conversation. And if you've got any questions for the panel, I guess can we do it outside on your way to a nice glass of beer or wine? Thank you all.